This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Ellen Brown, who developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. Ellen is author of 11 books, including her most recent book, Web of Debt, an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust. Ellen Brown is here today to tell us about the growing movement for publicly owned banks. Her articles on this topic may be found online at yesmagazine.org. Welcome, Ellen.
Thanks, Dan.
Let's start with a very basic question. What are publicly owned banks? What's the definition?
Well, actually, some people have pointed out that there's a certain confusion there because most people think publicly owned means a company that has gone public, meaning they've put their stock out to be purchased on the open market. But what I mean is government-owned, basically. The reason I said publicly-owned as opposed to state-owned is that you could have a bank owned by a state, or it could be a city, or it could be a county, or it could even be something like a university system. The University of California has a lot of money tucked away in investment pools that could be used as a capital base for their own bank, and then they could leverage that money, or you can lend many times more money than you actually have as your startup capital. So that's the good of a bank, is that all of our money is actually created by banks. It all comes from debt. There's no money in our money system except debt. That's what my book, Web of Debt, is all about, is that people think that the government issues the money and it's out there as legal tender, but actually it's private banks that issue the money, and it's all issued as credit, and it's all owed back to somebody.
What are the advantages of publicly owned banks over privately owned banks?
A publicly owned bank or a state-owned bank has the advantage that it can play the same banking game that the banks play and create its own money. Well, there's one state in the country that has its own bank, and that's North Dakota. And it has a mission statement in which it says that its purpose is to help the farmers, help the community, develop alternative energy, help student loans, et cetera. So it's there for public purposes, whereas a corporation, a private bank, is required by law to do the thing that will make the most money for its shareholders. So if that means, for instance, if you're Goldman Sachs and you have a high-frequency computer program that knows how to skim profits off of everybody else's trade in the stock market, and you have a choice between that and making loans to startup businesses that might fail, you're actually bound by law to speculate and do the thing that will make the most money, even if it's not producing anything and even if it's actually ultimately bad for the environment. The external costs aren't considered. So that's one difference, is that it serves the public. It's designed to serve the public. They can take the long-range view and do 10-year projects instead of always worrying about their 3-month quarterly bottom line. But besides that, what they can do is actually create the money needed for all these things that we know states need, that the people need, and we're just not getting the money from Wall Street. It's not trickling down like it was supposed to. Wall Street was bailed out by the government. $700 billion has now turned into $4.8 trillion. That much money has actually gone to the banks. $24 trillion is the estimated potential liability, but the actual money that's gone out is $4.8 trillion. They pay back $2 trillion, but there's still another $2 trillion plus that's out there that we, the taxpayers, have underwritten. So the banks have gotten all this amazing benefits, like because of the collapse and the bailout, they get to borrow from each other at the interbank lending rate, which is 0 to 0.25%. In other words, 0.25%. They get the best interest rates around. And meanwhile, we, the states, are paying the highest rates that the states have paid, you know, in the recent environment with these very low interest rates, because the rating agencies lost their ratings and therefore the states lost their ratings. So the bond issues, the interest rates on the bond issues went up. So the states, nobody has bailed us out. And we're paying in California 4% interest average to borrow money, whereas the banks are paying 0 to 0.25% interest to borrow money. So if you're a bank, you can then capitalize on all those benefits that banks get.
Looking back to the beginning of the United States, what is the historical precedent for publicly owned banks?
For the first 100 years, before we were actually a country, we had publicly issued money, and it was a brilliant invention of the American colonists. They didn't have gold and silver, and so it was actually the governor of Massachusetts that got this idea of paying his soldiers when he didn't have the money to pay them with these little paper receipts. And basically it was like, we acknowledge that you've done work for the community, and now you're entitled to go out and spend these receipts for an equivalent amount of goods and services in the community. And the community recognized that because these receipts were required in the payment of taxes, and that's what gave them their legitimacy. So they had their own banks, and the best of the systems was in Benjamin Franklin's colony of Pennsylvania. And he wrote about it and raved about it and said that this was responsible for the abundance and growth. And a number of people remarked how well the colonists had done. They'd gone off to this wilderness where there was nothing, and suddenly it was flourishing. And where did they get the money? They had actually created the credit with their own bank. In Pennsylvania, before they got this idea of setting up their own bank, they had to borrow from the British bankers at 8% interest gold or gold-backed paper notes. So that worked remarkably well all the way up until the 1750s. During that time, the Pennsylvanians paid no taxes. They had no government debt, and prices did not inflate. So it was totally sustainable, the perfect banking system. But then King George stepped in and said that the colonists could no longer issue their own money. And he did that because, well, the British bankers leaned on him, but also it was the British merchants were complaining because they were dealing with all these different colonies that had all these different money systems, and they didn't really know what they were getting paid in. And some of the colonies were pretty irresponsible about how they did their money, so they just printed and printed, and they didn't have this sustainable bank system going. So they just put money out there, and that did inflate the money supply, which devalued the currency. It was all kind of trial and error, so you had these various little experiments going on in all these different colonies. So King George said no more of that, that they couldn't issue their own money and that they had to pay their taxes in gold or the British banknotes. So there was an instant depression because they had had their own money, everything was moving along swimmingly, and then suddenly the money was gone. Well, actually, they were still using their old money, but they weren't allowed to issue any new money. And they had to pay their taxes in gold, which they didn't have. So they were just like a third world country that has to borrow from the IMF and pay in dollars that they don't have. It put them at the mercy of a foreign power. So finally, they just went back to printing their own money. And this was considered an act of rebellion by the king, since he had specifically said they couldn't do it. So that was apparently, according to some historians, what really precipitated the revolution. It wasn't just the tax on tea, it was the fact that they owed this tax in a currency, not their own, and they weren't allowed to issue their own currency.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is author Ellen Brown. Our topic is the growing movement for publicly owned banks. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. You have written articles about the recent movement toward publicly owned banks, again, having them come back into our culture. What is driving this movement?
Well, all the states have a credit freeze. I mean, they're all not able to meet their budgets, all but one. There's one state that actually has a surplus, and that is North Dakota, the only state that has its own bank. And it's had this bank since 1919. And it was instituted under the same conditions that we have today. The farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers, and they got tired of their money going out of state. They wanted to keep their money in state, and they wanted to generate their own credit. So they got together and formed something called the Nonpartisan League, and they did manage to win an election, and they got their bank in place. And the movement today is also nonpartisan. There are seven candidates who are proposing a state-owned bank in their platforms in seven different states. So there's three Democrats, two Greens, one Republican, and one Independent. So they're all across the spectrum. And then there are five states that actually have bills pending: Washington State, Illinois, Massachusetts, Virginia, and Michigan. So Michigan, for example, is desperate. People are fleeing the state. Detroit is, it's not that people can't afford the houses. There's nobody there to buy them. They've left the city. So there are parts of Detroit, I understand, that look like a war zone. And I saw the banking commissioner for Michigan was complaining that the problem is the banking rules, that they have to value these houses at what they could fetch today on the market. So say you had a $100,000 property and it goes into default, and the neighbor's homes are only selling for $10,000 because nobody's buying. So suddenly your $100,000 asset becomes a $10,000 asset, and because your asset is fanned into 10 times that sum in loans, you have suddenly, or before you could make $1 million in loans, suddenly you can only make $100,000 in loans. So the banks are not able to lend just because of these banking rules. They need more capital. Well, a state has a huge amount of capital and a huge amount of deposits. In North Dakota, the bank is set up as North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota. So technically, all the assets of the state are the assets of the bank. And by law, all of the revenues of the state go into this bank. So that's their deposit base. In order to make loans, you need both capital and deposits. But they've got them. So every state has them and could follow this same model. All these different politicians who are talking about it have different ideas. So, for instance, Fareed Kavari, he's running as a Democrat in Florida, and his idea is to actually do the state-owned bank like a commercial bank. So they would actually lend to homeowners at very low interest, and they would still make money because of this whole leverage thing where the bank can take its assets and fan it into many times that sum in loans, and then even lending at 2% interest to the homeowners, they'll still make a profit because they've created 9 loans out of 1 piece of capital. And then in, I think it's Washington State, that they're talking about doing it just like North Dakota, where it's really a banker's bank, where they're really partnering with other banks and sort of acting like a central bank, like the Federal Reserve. So it's kind of like in the American colonies. You have all these states that are experimenting with something new, and they all have different, I mean, they haven't actually done it, of course, but there are all these 5 bills pending, which is remarkable, I think. I've been writing on this subject for 1.5 years now, and I just keep beating the bushes trying to point out how this problem could be fixed by having our own credit mechanisms. So I think I've sparked some thought.
There seem to be a number of politicians who are stepping forward and proposing having publicly owned banks in their states. What kind of resistance is there politically to this idea?
Well, I saw in Michigan some Republicans, it's largely a Democratic proposal, and so a Republican said that this was socialism and that Michigan can't afford, the proposal is $150 million as an initial capital deposit. But now Fareed Kavari in Florida says, to the charge of socialism. No, he says socialism is where the people serve the state. He says what I'm talking about is where the state serves the people. You know, socialism is where the government owns the means of production. Well, a bank is something different. Really, all money is a series of legal agreements. That's what credit is. So we have a publicly owned court system. You wouldn't want a private judge who could be bought off dealing with your lawsuits. So likewise, when you're talking about credit, which is merely created on the books of banks, that's how they do it, you should have a public entity doing that as well. It's just mathematically sustainable if the profits go back to the state or the people. But if the profits are siphoned out of it all the time, then it's a pyramid scheme. And we've been doing this pyramid scheme for 300 years, and we've come to the end of the line.
Let's go into a bit more detail about the bank in North Dakota, the one state that does have its own bank that's owned by the state. Would you just highlight again what have been the advantages to the state of North Dakota of having its own bank?
Well, it's the only state that's actually adding jobs when other states are all losing jobs, and it's the only state that's able to meet its budget. And how do you explain that? I mean, some people say, well, it's got oil. When I first started writing about this, there were 4 states that were able to make their budgets without cutbacks. And then there were 3, and then there were 2. I mean, I kept saying, no, it's because they have their own bank. And then people would say, well, there are these 3 other states that can do it, and there's these 2 other states, and then there's 1 other state. Now it's the only one. The other one was Montana, but I just read recently that they're projecting that I think in 2011 they're going to have to cut back on services and that they're just not going to have enough money for their budget. So you could say North Dakota has oil. They do have oil, but many states have oil.
Does the Bank of North Dakota take deposits from citizens?
It does. It takes deposits from the state and elsewhere. It has a very good student loan program, and it makes loans to startup farmers for 1%. So it does a lot of benefits. I saw that there was an exemption in the health care bill. Slipped in there was the student loan bill, which said that the government was now going to do direct lending of all its loans, and it wasn't going to use banks as intermediaries. Well, this is actually a 45-year failed program where it's been underwriting the losses of the banks, and the government has just been very expensive for the government. It's cheaper to do direct lending, to be the bank. But there was this exemption in there for North Dakota. They weren't going to use any more middlemen banks except North Dakota. And so people got all over the North Dakota senator who put that in there. They said, oh, this is pork, you know, a special exemption for North Dakota. So he took it out because he didn't want to make the Bank of North Dakota look bad. But in fact, he argued that it wasn't pork. And in fact, the Bank of North Dakota, the default rate on their loans was like half the default rate in the rest of the country, because they did not sell off their loans like the other banks did, you know, sell them off to investors so they don't worry about whether it's a good credit risk. And they were shepherding their loans. They would help the students to pay and work things out with them. So they were overseeing these loans in a good way. And if every state did that and had their own bank, then it would certainly help the federal government. It would relieve them of this huge burden of suddenly having to fund all the students that have to get loans.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is author Ellen Brown. Our topic is the growing movement for publicly owned banks. In North Dakota, are the deposits FDIC insured or only insured by the state funds?
They're only insured by the state. And at one point, people were saying, you see, it's risky. They're not FDIC insured. Well, you know, the FDIC is now going bankrupt. So they're actually better off in North Dakota because that state is a very stable, profitable state. And one reason they're profitable is that the bank returns a dividend every year. I mean, all the profits from the bank go back to the state.
And how would the success of the North Dakota bank translate to larger states?
Well, that is something that people debate, but I think it would work very well. I mean, I think that, for instance, California has more resources than North Dakota does. I know the figures in California because I've looked into it. California is currently $18 billion in the red, and yet they have $70 billion managed by the treasurer in an investment pool, $70 billion that the governor cannot touch because these are all investments of various funds or counties, municipalities. So we have all this money, and every state has all this money managed by, in an investment pool, pension funds, et cetera. Well, you can't spend the pension funds, obviously, but the pension funds themselves are trying to make money. They're trying to grow assets for their pensioners. So what you could do, the treasurer is charged with managing these funds. So he could earmark, let's say, $10 billion and pledge them as capital for a bank. And whoever's money it is, whichever fund it belongs to, he would give them something extra. Like, let's say this money consists of bonds that are drawing 4%. So he could pledge the bonds, so they're still drawing 4% for whoever owns them, and then pay them an extra 1% for using it as a capital for this bank. Now, if that fund needs the money out, fine. There's so much other money in the investment pool, they'll probably be clamoring to get into this better investment. So you've got that sort of capital. And then for deposits, if we did like North Dakota, California right now has $17 billion on deposit. So that's enough to fund, well, certainly $17 billion in loans. It depends on how you read the rules. So California has a huge potential for creating credit on its books. And even just if you're talking about just for its own needs, instead of borrowing at 4%, it could be borrowing at 0.25% like the other banks.
How long is it likely to take to set up a public bank once a state has passed the necessary legislation?
Well, they could fast track this stuff. You could set up a bank in a matter of a couple of months. It's, you know, there are banks that are online banks. You don't even need a building, but of course you want a nice building so that you look like a reputable bank. But for instance, it's supposed to take months for a bank to become a commercial bank. Goldman Sachs switched over from investment bank to commercial bank overnight, like literally overnight. So if they wanted to fast track it, if everybody understood what the benefits were here and why we need to do this and how foolish it is that we're in this credit crisis when we've got everything we need. We've got the people, we've got the labor, we've got the resources. We just don't have the money to put them together. Well, money is only a medium of exchange. We can create that. So, in other words, the governor could do it by executive order, or the legislature could do it very quickly. But the problem is, you know how legislatures are. It takes so long to convince everybody that it's a good idea. That's the slow part.
How would the formation of publicly owned state banks likely affect the current for-profit banks?
In North Dakota, it helps the other banks. The other banks like the Bank of North Dakota because it acts like a central bank, and so it provides the capital and the funds. What happened to most banks was that when the housing market collapsed, it used to be that investors would buy these collateralized debt obligations, which were these bundles of mortgages wrapped in a derivative. They would buy that as securities and take the loans off the bank's books, and then the bank could make more loans and more loans and more loans. So there was a huge potential for credit. And then when the collateralized debt obligations proved to be not AAA after all, they proved to be very risky, nobody wanted to buy them anymore. So that whole market went away. The Chinese, the Japanese, the Europeans, all those people that were buying our mortgage-backed securities realized that this was a very risky scam, and they abandoned it. And when that happened, a $10 trillion hole resulted in the money supply. I mean, that much in credit just evaporated. It just went away. So in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota serves as the big bank that can buy up those loans and allow the little banks to make more loans and more loans. So they actually backstop the little banks, the community banks.
How do the credit unions fit into the public banking model?
Credit unions, as I understand it, they don't actually leverage. In other words, they lend the money they have and not more. So they're good, sound community sort of thing. But they don't have the potential for, let's say you wanted to build a dam or a railroad or something. They don't have the potential for creating millions of dollars of credit on their books and funding the thing that then will create the profits that will pay the loan back.
So how will public banks most help Main Street?
Right now we have a lack of credit. You know, small businesses can't get loans like they used to. Homeowners are having trouble getting loans. It's because Wall Street is not making loans anymore because they're bad credit risks. Wall Street is, or the big banks are not able to sell off their loans like they used to. It used to be they didn't care how risky these loans were because they weren't going to get stuck with them. But now they are stuck with them, and there's a limit to how much the banks can lend. So the state banks could get that credit machine going again. We could have abundant credit like we had a few years ago.
In your view, how likely is it that the U.S. will create an extensive public banking system?
Well, that's a very good question. Hope springs eternal. I think it's our only alternative. There is an effort globally to take away the ability of countries either to issue their own money or to borrow from their own publicly owned banks. And we are falling right into that trap. We're falling for all this hype about, oh, we have this horrible federal debt and we have to tighten our belts. The federal debt is not actually the problem because the federal debt is our money supply. The problem is the interest. If the government created that money itself or if it borrowed from its own central bank interest-free, the debt itself is not a problem because the debt is merely credit, which is what you need to run an economy. I mean, I just keep trying and hoping because I think it's our only alternative. It does seem like more and more people are coming to that realization. I was actually quite amazed to see those five bills just appear.
What steps have been taken at the federal level toward public banking?
Right now, there's a proposal for a green bank, which is part of the energy bill. And the green bank would be owned by the government and would begin with $10 billion capital from the government, and then over 5 years that could be increased to $50 billion. But then the plan is that could be used to leverage or to multiply many times over into 10 times that sum or $500 billion in credit, which would be used to develop all these small startup different green businesses. Also, there's the fact that the education bill says that the government will now be issuing the loans directly for students. So that is a form of going into banking. They're going to be borrowing from the Treasury at 2.8% interest and re-lending it at 6.8 interest to the students. So then there's the 4% spread in there. So that really technically makes the education department a bank. But if they actually set up as a bank, then they could do the same interbank lending arrangement that other banks have. In other words, instead of borrowing at 2.8%, they could get their money at 0 to 0.25%. Plus, the Federal Reserve itself rebates the interest that it gets to the government after deducting its costs. So what everybody complains about, which is the government borrowing from the Federal Reserve, which means the Federal Reserve is actually printing money, that's what everybody says, and everybody says that's hyperinflationary. In fact, that is the cheapest way that we can get money. That is where the government should be getting its money. Now, the Federal Reserve does not want to rebate the interest. When it was first set up as a private entity in 1913, the federal income tax was set up right along with it in order to have a source for paying the interest that was going to be owed to the Federal Reserve for all this money that they were about to create and lend to the government. But in the 1960s, Wright Patman, who was head of the Banking and Currency Committee, peered closely and saw what they were up to, and he said, you are printing our money, lending it to us, and charging us interest on it. That is fraudulent. And so he thought they should be nationalized, but they weren't, but they agreed to rebate the interest. So ever since, the profits of the Federal Reserve have gone back to the government after they deduct out their costs. So that is a form of government banking, even though it's a little bit indirect. It would be more direct if we actually nationalized the Federal Reserve, but it's a step.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
We've had for 300 years two competing banking systems, a publicly owned system and a privately owned system. The original system of the American colonists was the publicly owned money, and that was a brilliant system. And the privately owned system is a pyramid scheme because the profits are always siphoned off the top. And that means that because banks create the principal but they don't create the interest necessary to pay off their loans, somebody somewhere has to be going into debt, further into debt, to support this pyramid. And we've run out of debtors. The whole world is now in debt. So that system has come to the end. The parasite has exhausted its food source. So we have to switch back to the publicly owned bank and credit and money generating system, and that's the only way we're going to survive. It's either that, or we're going into totalitarian, oligarchical centralization from abroad, from an international cartel of financiers.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Ellen.
Thank you, Diane.
We have just been listening to author Ellen Brown speak about the growing movement for publicly owned banks. For more information, check on the web at www.public-banking.com. Again, that's public-banking.com. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.